Okay, my name is Atandi. I'm from Dickinson College, and I'm interviewing Mr. Johnny Lewis. I hope you give us the permission to record the interview.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Okay, first I want to ask you to give us a brief history of your life, where you were born, and things like that.
I was born in McGee, Mississippi, Simpson County, which is about 42 miles south of Jackson, Mississippi, the capital city. Went to elementary school, high school there, and came here to Clarksdale in 1956-57 as a freshman at the community college. Graduated in 1959, went back to Jackson State, and in 1961 I graduated from Jackson State and came back to Clarksdale in August of 1961 as a teacher of English at the local high school, Higgins High School at that time. And I worked at Higgins until 1970. The schools integrated, and Higgins closed down as a high school and became a junior high school, and we all went to Clarksdale High. And I worked at Clarksdale High for 2 years, and then I left there and went to the community college and worked 1 year there. And in 1972, June of that year, I left the teaching profession full time and went to Southland Management Corporation, where I've been until this day. So, but I did remain in the teaching profession for several years after that as a part-time instructor at the junior college or community college. And presently, as I said, I am managing a 100-unit federally subsidized housing complex. And basically, that's what I've been doing up until this time. I've had the opportunity to work in the civil rights movement. As a school teacher, it was almost unheard of for teachers at that time to be involved in the civil rights movement. We were not allowed to do so. If it were found out that we were involved in any kind of movement like that, we would be fired. Many of us, however, did participate, even when we filled our contracts out every year. On the contracts, they required for you to list the names of the organizations to which you belong. And many of us never would put on there, or none of us would put on that contract that we were members of the NAACP, but most of us were. Secretly we paid our dues, and secretly we attended meetings and did what we felt we had to do to assist the organization.
And how was like growing up during the segregation years before 1970, how was life then?
I grew up, as I said, in South Central Mississippi, and it was no different there than here, because in Mississippi at that time everything was segregated. As a boy growing up, I was taught by my parents, quote unquote, what my place was. I knew that there were certain things that you didn't do, you didn't say, there were certain places you didn't go, because it was just taboo. For instance, if you were on the street and walking down the street and a group of whites were approaching you, you got off the street and let them pass by, and then you got back on the street to go where you were going. My part of the state, as I said before, was no different from any other place in Mississippi. We went to segregated schools. Our schools were the worst schools one could think of. What few books we did have, when we got them, they were books that had been discarded by the white schools, because many times when you look in the front of the books for the names and the years that they had been used, you know, the names of people who had them and that kind of thing, sometimes there would be four or five names in there, which means that book had been used 4 or 5 years ago by those different students.
And did you yourself ever directly experience racism?
Oh, of course. Of course. I hope that when you say racism, that you really mean the things of which I've already spoken, or if there is some particular incident. Now, as far as particular incident of my having been attacked or anything like that by somebody, no, I never was, because as I said, as a young boy, I was taught by my parents my place, and I knew my place and I stayed in my place. And when I got old enough to do what I could do to try to correct the situation or to help out in the correction of the situation, I did just that.
And in your teaching profession, you are teaching English, what kind of things did you actually teach the students?
Basically, I taught them grammar. How to write, how to speak. I taught also literature. I taught them American literature. I taught them English lit. All of the basic classics of American and English lit. We studied American authors. We studied authors like Longfellow. We studied William Faulkner. We studied Emerson, Carl Sandburg, any of the major American artists. as far as English authors were concerned, we poets, writers, we studied Chaucer, we studied Milton, we studied Shakespeare, same thing any other high schools would have been teaching at that time.
But did they ever allow you to use any African American writers? Or?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. We were required basically to teach from the textbooks that we were issued. And those textbooks were selected by the Board of Education. And the Board of Education selected those books that had nothing whatsoever in them about blacks. As a matter of fact, even as a college student, it was not until I got to be in my sophomore, junior, senior year that I really learned about some of our Mississippi black writers, you know, because through high school we had none of that. But then as a teacher of English, I always had those students who were at that time, by the time I'm out of school, see, this is 60s, this is in the 60s, and then by this time many black writers had been published, and it was kind of commonplace by now to read or to have books by black poets, and black poets were very, very popular during that time, and many of my students on their own, we would exchange poems and writers and things like that. But to say in the classroom teaching this, no, couldn't do that. No.
And was the civil rights movement, was it very, in let's say Coma County, was there a lot of civil rights activities? Were there a lot of activities in the city?
Yes, by all means. I can recall, and this is something that we did in later years, and when I say we, I have reference to black people in general, and even teachers were involved in this. The movements that we used were protests, where we launched protests against the stores downtown and the businesses around town where blacks did a lot of shopping or trading that had no blacks in employment except in menial jobs. We protested and picketed those stores, even boycotted them. And it was not uncommon for us to have marches downtown. I've seen many Saturdays. All of the citizens, black citizens in the town were asked to come out and join a protest movement, and we would march over town. Now, we had to get permits from the city fathers to march, and they would say where you could and could not go. And we stayed within those bounds, but we made it known that we were dissatisfied with the situations that were going on. I can recall after I left the teaching profession and in 1972, I became deeply involved with the NAACP in this county, and I worked, as a matter of fact, I served as the chairman of the political action committee of the local branch, and it was during that time that I, along with several others in the group, filed a lawsuit against the city, to a lawsuit in federal court against the city to enjoin them from holding another election until such time that we had changed the form of government to where more blacks could get elected according to the population of the city. And at that particular time, we were operating under a form of government called at-large system. And with the lawsuit that we filed required them to go to a ward system. And the only way you get elected in a ward system is if you live in the wards. And then from that, we had to come together and negotiate the number of people in the wards and draw the lines for the wards and all of that based on the population of the citizens. And in so doing, we ended up with three wards, two of which could actually be won outright by blacks because they had heavily predominant black populations. But then that third ward in there had maybe like 54% voting age population, which means that if people actually went out and voted, they could win that, but we haven't been able to win that third ward yet. However, the mayor was the only one that is elected at large. So from that action, we have been able to elect two African Americans to the board and an African American as mayor. So out of a board of five, there we have three African Americans on the board.
And how would you say the transition between segregation and desegregation? How was that here?
The transition from segregation to desegregation, I would say it has gone fairly well, but now when I say fairly well, like we must be realistic. We still have a long ways to go when it comes to actual integration. We are desegregated, but we are not truly integrated. And surely you know what I mean by that. Nobody tells me anymore that I can't go in this restaurant downtown, or I can't go in this place. But then I know that even today, there are people that don't want me there. They don't want to associate with me, you know. So this town has come a long ways. I've seen this town grow as far as race relations is concerned. But then, and I know there will always be those among us who will have problems with race, and I think maybe it's not only on the other side. There are some among my race who don't particularly care for the other side, you know. So it's a two-way street, I think. But all in all, I'd say Clarksdale is on its way, has some distance to go, but it's still traveling.
Was there a lot of migration by the whites out of Clarksdale once desegregation came to form?
Yes. There's always been what we call here in the South white flight. There's no different here than anywhere else. When these kinds of things take place, many of the whites, for instance, in the school system, when we integrated the schools, many of the white students left the school system. And today, our school system, I would think, is better than 70% black. Yeah. Private schools popped up all around. They are in existence today.
Yeah. And did that disable? What happened? Was the economy affected very much here in Clarksdale?
Yes, that is why. Anytime people begin to leave your city or your county, naturally that does something to your tax base. Mm-hmm. And when your tax base decreases, that means your support for schools and things like that disappear or decreases also with it. So very definitely that has had an effect on the city and the county in general, yes.
Have there been any moves towards sort of counteracting that negative impact?
Yes. Many of our factories left, and I'm not even sure that we can blame that on integration, because that's more or less a national thing. Factories all over this country have, you know, pulled up and moved out of many cities and towns across America. But a number of things are going on in this town now and in this county to try to bring. We are constantly searching for new industry, which seems hard to come by, because right now we are looking at the possibility of a biodiesel factory coming to town, with this being the Delta and all of this rich Delta land here for growing things. We think that the growth of corn and soybeans and things out of which they can make diesel fuel and stuff will be a great thing. And just here recently in our local paper, I saw where we are hopefully gonna get us a biodiesel plant coming to town.
Yeah, and what about Head Start? How has that functioned here?
Head Start, incidentally, Head Start is one of the major employers of here in this county. And Coahoma County is it is one of the first counties to have Head Start. Coahoma County, along with I believe in the state of Minnesota it may have been, are the two places where Head Start originated. They were used as pilot programs. And since that time, it has been Head Start that has really helped this county. I would think that it helped the county more in moving toward integration than any other movement, you know, because through the Head Start program, or with the Head Start program, came other federal grants. And one of those was community development grants. And in those community development grants were people were hired to be community organizers. And those community organizers organized those people in the various communities where these Head Start centers were and got them registered and started them voting. And from that, that is how we end up today in this county with the chief law enforcement officer, the sheriff, is black. The chief of police in this town is black. We just recently fired the chief of the fire department, who was black, and we hired a white guy. But I mean, you know, like those positions that had once been all white and maybe one token black here and there no longer exist. So with Head Start came, I think, the really the upward movement of the black race in this county.
Are there a lot of white folk involved in Head Start, or is it just majority?
Absolutely, it's majority black. And that's not because that blacks discriminate. And incidentally, I serve on the board of directors of Cohoma Opportunities Incorporated, which is the community action agency that operates Head Start in this county. And the absence of whites is not because they are discriminated against. We are an equal employment opportunity agency, and we could not operate under federal guidelines any other way, you know. Yeah. And if they don't come, it's just because they don't choose to. When we have vacancies, we advertise for them, and people just don't come. As far as participation on the part of children, if I'm not mistaken, we may have in one of our Head Start centers over in the Birth of Blackburn Head Start Center, we may have two white children over there. But all the rest of them are blacks, and maybe there are very few Hispanics.
And I know you've had your involvement in terms of the blues and the blues museum. How has the blues tourism affected the economy of Clarksville?
Yeah, I've had some involvement with the blues. I am a board member also of the Delta Blues Museum. And trust me, it is the Delta Blues that has been one of the big or I might even say huge things that has happened that is bringing tourists into town and has really helped to pick up the economy in this area. As I said, in our serving on the board each month, we get a report of the number of people who came through the museum, where, from what state they came, and the number of countries from which they came. And I would say on an average, we each month we would have somewhere in the neighborhood of 30, 35 states, 600, 700, 800 people come through from the states, and on an average of 15 to 20 foreign countries from which people come through the museum, and that's on a monthly basis. And during the month of April, when we have the Juke Joint Festival, gee whiz, the town is just crawling with people from all over the world. And the same thing holds true during the month of August, when we have the Blues Festival. People come from everywhere. And just, well, now coming up in the next week or so, when Helena, Arkansas, right across the bridge from us here, 35 miles away, will be holding what used to be called the King Biscuit Blues Festival, but now they call it the Arkansas Blues and Gospel Heritage Festival, I believe. They had to change their name because of some legal problems. But anyway, that festival draws quite a few people into town, because any time they come there, they're going to want to come to Clarksdale to see the museum and to go to the juke joints that are here.
And how did you actually get involved in the Blues Museum? How did you end up there?
Well, I was appointed by the city commissioner from this ward. See, that's the goodness of that ward system. Prior to this, I never would have been a member of that board. Prior to our changing that form of government, that just helps to bring more and more people into the operations of the city or things that go on in the city. But I was appointed to the board by my commissioner, and he's in his second term, and as long as he's in office and I keep him satisfied, and then he keeps appointing me, and he's in Ward 3. We are in Ward 3, so his appointment is a 3-year. When he appoint me, that's 3-year term that I'll serve. So I'm in my second term, which is, the last year this coming fall. I mean, spring will be the end of my second 3-year term. Yeah.
And have you been involved in it since it was in the library, or when it was?
Well, to tell you the truth, I was involved in the museum before it was really a museum. The man who started the museum, Sid Graves, was the librarian. This was in his lifetime. He was a blues lover. I was a blues lover. And he started, I used to go down to the library. Now this was before we were even allowed to go in Carnegie Library over where it is now. We had a little branch of it over on the highway 61 in our neighborhood called Myrtle Hall Branch Library. And he had a corner set up in a room. And he had some blues albums there. And I would go in and listen to some of those. And I even took him some John Lee Hooker down there a couple of times, you know, and he would play them on the thing. And then the thing started to grow. It got, you know, they moved it out of that corner because it finally took up, you know, more space than they had, and they moved it down to the main library and put it in a room there, which was larger. And soon it outgrew that, and that's why the city bought this building that it's in now, which is the old train depot. They bought that building and then moved it out of the library into the depot. Now, that was the beginning of the board of directors, or board of trustees, they're called. But anyway, I was appointed by my commissioner to serve on that board. So that's how we got. So I've been involved in that from the very beginning, but in a small way, you know. Yeah.
And like you say, you're a blues. You like blues very much, right?
Oh, I love the blues. I grew up around the blues. In my part of Mississippi, down in South Central Mississippi, I lived in a sawmill quarter. And you know what the word quarters mean. Well, the word quarters is an area that's kind of set apart from, in other words, if you've got 15 houses over in this section of town, they would call that those, there was a sawmill in the area where I lived, and they called that the sawmill quarters. Well, in another section of town, which was called Goodwater, they called that the Goodwater quarters. So in my quarters, there was a juke joint. Now, juke joints were usually what we would call a cafe. It was just maybe a house there that somebody cooked fish sandwiches, and sold drinks, and maybe had a jukebox sitting in there. And in those days, they didn't call them jukeboxes, they called them seabirds. Yeah, and you go in, I used to sit out on my back doorsteps and listen to the music coming out of there. And that was what I was hearing. And I just fall in love with it. I learned to sing those songs, you know. Yeah.
And how important was blues to the black folk?
Very. You see, blues was black people's way of expressing themselves. The poet sits down with his pen in hand, and he pens a poem. The black man with the blues, the blues player, he sits down with his guitar or his harmonica, whatever the instrument, or if he has no instrument, but and he pens a song or plays a song or sings a song, and it's a way of expressing a feeling that he has, or letting go of some emotion that he has. Somebody, I don't know who it was, I've heard this phrase, and it sure isn't original with me. I've heard somebody say, the blues ain't nothing but a good man feeling bad, you know. And he tells his story of what it is that makes him feel bad. Yeah. So, blues expresses inner feelings.
Yeah. And how did the blues come to be in controversy with the church?
Well, if you stop and think about it now, the people who sing the blues are the people who go to church. They are in church on, well, let's say it this way, they work all the week, Monday through Friday, and sometimes Saturdays too, till noon. That used to be the thing. And then that Saturday afternoon, they went out and they had fun. And then Sunday morning, they got up and went to church. Now, the songs that they sang in church, many times those blues singers would take those same songs but change the lyrics to them and sing a blues song. Where you talking about on Sunday morning, the I love the Lord, he heard my cry. The blues man may take that and say, I love my baby, you know, and put some more words to it to make it fit that same musical pattern. And the hurt that one has of a lost love, what do we do when we hurt? We cry out to God. And the blues man cries out to that lost lover. All the different. One is to somebody, the other one is to something greater than we. Yeah.
And now jumping over to gospel music, what effect do you think that had in the civil rights movement?
Oh, man. Gospel music and the civil rights movement go hand in hand, because it's gospel music that gives you spirit and inspiration. When you hear some of the songs that the people sang during the civil rights movement, you just know that they are seeking the inspiration and spirit from God for guidance, and that's the only way you make it, you know. I can recall, and I know you know, you probably don't, but there is a black woman from years back by the name of Mahalia Jackson. One of those old men who had such a big voice. I mean, and one of the most melodious voices one would ever want to hear. And it was somebody like her would get up in one of those civil rights rallies and sing one of those good old spirituals, you know. Soon I will be done with the troubles of this world. So, you know, something like that, boy, that would get you going. Yeah, that would get you going. That would get the spirits up and people be ready to go out and march.
And is the church still playing the same role of pushing people?
It depends on the church. And one would have to say that when you go back, you look at the role that the church played in at during the height of the civil rights movement. There was something that was missing from our lives, from black people's lives, and that was, quote unquote, freedom, liberty, those words that our Constitution, you know, guarantees us, and that kind of thing, and it was missing. So, at that time, people were fighting for those things, and the church was where they gathered and held their rallies and things, and you know, they sang, one of the songs they sang was, "We Shall Overcome Someday." Well, today, many of blacks kind of feel like we have overcome. But, and when we look at, see what I got in my chair?
I see it.
Barack Obama. Change we can believe in, Martin Luther King had the dream. Barack Obama answered to that dream. So many feel like maybe we have already overcome. Not true, not so. We've come a long ways, but we still have some distance to go. In yesterday's paper, there was a cartoon on the editorial page, and they had Martin Luther King Jr. up on the mountaintop, and he had a paper in his hand, a newspaper, and on the newspaper were the captions, "I Have a Dream," and they had this scrummy little figure of Barack Obama climbing up the mountain, and Martin was reaching back down trying to give him a hand, you know. In other words, he's almost there, but he hasn't made it yet. So that's where we are. We've come a long ways, but we still haven't gotten to the mountaintop.
How did you feel, or how are you feeling right now since the election and of Obama?
Ecstatic. Ecstatic, man. I don't know how. I find myself pinching myself sometimes, and I say, like my wife and my sister-in-law and I were talking this afternoon, and my sister-in-law said, "I still can't believe it. I still feel like I'm dreaming, like it's not true, you know." And I told her, I say, "Well, I'm still in that same predicament too, because it's just hard to believe." I never thought that I would see this day in my lifetime. And I'm, in the next couple of weeks, I'll be 72 years old. And I never thought I'd see this day. Never did. My mother-in-law is 95 years old. And the night that he won, my wife and her sister were hollering and shouting and going on. And she asked them, said, "What's the matter?" And they said, "A black man won the president of the United States. And today, they ask her, we call her Mama Lee. And they said, Mama Lee, say, who's the president of the United States?" And she said, "Y'all said a black man was." So we are all ecstatic, man. We just don't know how to thank God enough. Yeah.
And what effect do you think that will have on mostly, especially African Americans? What do you think the effect will be?
Well, I think that today, the black kids, children today can say, if I work hard, if I do the things that I'm supposed to do and get myself in a position, I can be anything that I want to be. And somebody once said a black man could do just about anything, but he could never be president. I heard that many a time. But now that glass ceiling has been broken. So I think that can have a tremendous impact on young blacks who are coming along.
We're going to change tapes real quick.
Okay, change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a bunch of questions I
want to
ask. You don't Friday night, right? Almost every Friday, Saturday night, they're going to have some music. Yeah. Those are Friday night.